VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello and welcome to the Game Podcast from The Times. I'm Natalie Sawyer.
And I'm Gabriel Marcotti, and I thank you for joining us on this Thursday. And in the studio with us is the very excellent James Gerbrandt. Down the line from somewhere no doubt posh in West London, it's Matt Dickinson.
Hello.
Later on we'll be talking about a tough time coming up for Tottenham and also where some of England's Nation League star performers go from here as they return to their club sides. And presumably a few fewer minutes on the pitch.
But we start with the game of the weekend in the Premier League. Jose Mourinho returns to Stamford Bridge as Manchester United make the trip to Chelsea, who are unbeaten under Maurizio Sarri. And Matt, we thought Mourinho was a goner both before the Newcastle game and also at half time. Were there signs in that second half that United have turned a corner?
It's so hard to say, isn't it? Because ultimately, you know, they clawed their way back in. Incredible drama, but you know, the idea that, you know, that suddenly cured everything, I think, is fanciful. I think, you know, basically Mourinho is still a guy who is fair to ask whether he wants to be there. Those questions remain very necessary, very legitimate, and will be asked this week, next week, and I suspect until the end of the season. And does anyone really think he's going to be manager of Manchester United next season?
Tom Clark has dissected Pogba's stats this season, which you can read, by the way, at thetimes.co.uk. And Tom finds that Pogba has had the most shots and second most passes in the opposition half of any midfielder. He's certainly involved, but is he maybe trying too much?
Well, I think we've seen the sort of turbulence in his United performances I thought, just because I love the phrase and I love the way it was applied, the Vieira column we did just at the start of the World Cup, where he used that phrase about, I won't try the French version, but of putting water in the wine, which, as Patrick explained, was about, in football terms, it was about stopping showing off, stopping. He was being too flamboyant, too try-hard in that sense, that he was trying to be too clever. He was over-elaborating his game and he needed to sort of dilute it, water in his wine, and simplify it. And I think that's exactly what we saw with France at the World Cup. And there's been a lot of rightful discussion about, you know, when you've got Kante next to you, that's probably a lot of a simpler job to do. With United, Mourinho made his name by being one of the most ordered, strategic, best plan. You know, I remember speaking to one of the Chelsea players in his first reign there about, well, they knew, you know, the nearest blade of grass they had to stand to in certain situations. This United team has lacked any kind of sense of clear purpose and pattern.
I think one of the things that is interesting slash difficult about Pogba, and you talked about the article that Tom wrote, I think Pogba does have, I think he does have quite a unique skill set, and I think, as Tom showed in the article that he wrote, he's a very good passer, and last season only, I think, four players had more assists than him in the Premier League.
They all played for City.
They're all Man City players, exactly. But he's not sort of, you know, he's not a pure creator. He's also very good at winning duels, for example, in the centre of the pitch. He can be, as you know, we've touched on in that France World Cup team, he can be a very disciplined, deep-lying playmaker, but equally, he's someone who is also very good getting forward and, you know, who can get shots off and attack the box. So I think there is a certain difficulty in managing a player like that who maybe doesn't sort of neatly fall into any categories. And I think with Mourinho, you know, it's not sort of, as we talked about many times, his attacking football, it's not super, super structured like, you know, for example, Maurizio Sarri's Chelsea. You know, there is a certain amount of improvisational kind of leeway afforded to his attacking players. And I think an interesting question is, you know, would Pogba be better off in a, in, you know, in a much more kind of structured, disciplined attack where, you know, maybe...
But based on what you suggest, though... And I agree with you that Mourinho's system is generally, you know, more ordered and the attack is more about individuals rather than patterns of play. Mm. That should actually favour Pogba in the sense that if the people around him are ordered, he's the guy who can improvise. He's the guy who can seek out the one-on-ones, make his talent be the difference, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm assuming this is probably... I'm going to give Mourinho the benefit of the doubt. Today is Be Nice to Mourinho Day.
Are you feeling all right, Gav?
No, honestly, especially if we talk about his FA charge, I will stick up for him. But I think the issue is he would have wanted to have the structured system and then Pogba with some leeway, maybe Sanchez with some leeway as well. Mm. I think what he ran into, though, is he decided that the other bits in his system either aren't good enough or he doesn't think they're good enough or he's... destroyed their confidence or just decided to blame them for no reason in some cases. But, you know, once you realize that you don't have that faith in Fred, in the center backs and the other pieces around you, all of a sudden, then you don't have Pogba operating as sort of the wild card in a structured system, but you just have chaos around him. And then he becomes part of the chaos, perhaps.
Completely. And obviously also, you know, not that there has to be, but, you know, as we talked about, the United team changes quite a lot from game to game. Yeah. The game plan changes quite a lot. So it's not like Pogba is doing his thing kind of within a very kind of settled system.
Gab, you mentioned the possible touchline ban. Can you expand on that any further for us with regards to Mourinho?
Yeah, this is nothing but pure idiocy by whoever went and charged him. And this ban relates to when he was walking off the pitch afterwards.
This is the Newcastle game.
In the Newcastle, yes. Yeah. He was mouthing something and waving his pinky in the air. It's not like he went up to a camera, stood in front of it, and started mouthing something, which, by the way, nobody heard because there was no audio to it. You could lip read if you happen to be deaf or if you happen to be a lip reader. But then you need to be able to lip read and also speak Portuguese because he was talking in Portuguese. And the BT Sport cameras, you know, caught him walking off the pitch. And because some people tweeted, ooh, he's... saying all sorts of nasty, obscene things, the FA looked into it. And I have several problems with this. First and foremost, the fact that it took him 10 days to charge him. The FA said they needed to get expert lip readers and language experts in. Here's a hint. The only reason to go and punish somebody for using obscenities is if they bring the game into disrepute, somehow reflect badly on your product, right? If it takes you 10 days to even figure out whether he said something he shouldn't have, most likely most people wouldn't have noticed it. And if you had just moved on from it, you wouldn't have attracted attention to this. That's the most basic point. But the other point is how many swearing to himself in a foreign language with the sound off is not something that the FA should be involved in, especially now. I don't know how much money they spent on these so-called language experts and so-called lip readers. And I'm naturally predisposed against lip readers because it was lip readers employed by newspapers that put somebody I've known for a long time, like Marco Materazzi, they absolutely crucified him in public for supposedly saying racist, horrible things to Zinedine Zidane. And it wasn't until Zidane himself came out and said, no, he never said anything racist or anything to do with terrorists or whatever. And then Marco rightly went and sued these newspapers and they had to settle and pay up. So my faith in lip readers is pretty low, especially of the kind that get, you know, these sort of hired guns who go in to provide services to associations like the FA and whatever. But leaving that to one side, is this really something that you want to spend time on? All this does is give Mourinho more fodder to be like, look, everybody's against me. They're part of the master underground conspiracy that ranges from Pogba to Eric Bai to Ed Woodward to the Glazers to Scholes and Rio Ferdinand. Everybody's against me. And he's not right in the sense there is no conspiracy, it only exists in his head, but he's right on this case.
Let's move away from Mourinho then, focus on the game at Stamford Bridge. James, people haven't really treated Chelsea as title challengers thus far. That will change with a victory, won't it?
Chelsea, I mean, they're top of their level on points at the top of the Premier League at the moment. Probably prior to the start of the season, I think most people probably peg Liverpool as City's closest challengers. I think obviously because of the success they've had in the Champions League, and I think their recruitment as well, and obviously I suppose they're more settled in terms of the manager. They're in a different phase of Klopp's project than Chelsea are, obviously under Sarri. But for me, just going on purely the football that they've played so far, I haven't seen much so far to separate Liverpool from Chelsea, to say that, you know, Liverpool are title contenders but Chelsea aren't, purely on the basis of what's going on the pitch. That may change. I think Chelsea do have vulnerabilities, but I think if they were to win here, I mean, clearly the squad has adapted to the demands of playing Sarri's style of football quite well and quite quickly. I think they will have to be in the conversation.
What are those vulnerabilities?
I think, as we saw in the game against Arsenal in the first half, they have certain defensive vulnerabilities. I think, obviously, like a lot of teams that play very much on the front foot, I think they certainly could be quite susceptible on the counter. And I think that is obviously reinforced by the fact that, A, you have one of the best counter-attack stoppers in world football, N'Golo Kanté, playing a slightly different role this season and maybe playing in a slightly more advanced position where he's not quite so able to stop counters. And also, I don't think Chelsea have been particularly... good at winning the ball back in the opposition half so far under Sarri. That may change and evolve. But I think certainly, you know, particularly with Conte slightly higher up the pitch, that central defensive pairing of Rudiger and David Luiz, which has been pretty good so far, I think could be, by really good attacks, I think could be got out.
This season, with your subscription to The Times and The Sunday Times, you can watch every highlight and every goal from every game in the Premier League. It's just £8 for an 8-week trial. Every Thursday at thetimes.co.uk, our stats guru Bill Edgar provides 11 trivia teasers for you, and here's one on this podcast. And our teaser today is, as of the start of the Premier League era in August 1992, Liverpool had won the most major trophies among English clubs, 33. But who was second on that list? I mean, we're going back a while, so you have to really think about it, but it's tricky.
Yeah, I don't know. I genuinely haven't looked at the end. I might have guessed Arsenal or Everton.
Okay.
I'm assuming it's not Manchester United because they won a ton afterwards. Mm-hmm. And obviously, we were very bad for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
But watch, it's going to be something stupid like Huddersfield or something. You know, the Herbert Chapman thing. I can't wait to find the answer.
Yes. Yeah, stick around to the end to find out. The first half in Seville on Monday was beyond every England fan's wildest dreams as Gareth Southgate's side raced into a 3-goal lead over Spain. 3-2 the final score as England recorded their first ever Nations League win. And Matt, how impressed were you particularly with that first half performance?
Well, who wasn't? No, I mean, it's 3-0 up against Spain after, 39 minutes in Spain. Takes some doing, but I'm really... Well, pleased on a number of ways. Obviously, there was the individual players. We saw Raheem Sterling, you know, sort of get that whole drought and that whole conversation sort of off his chest. We saw Rashford, who had, you know, stumbled over a couple of chances in Croatia. Come good. We saw Kane show that you don't have to be scoring goals to be so hugely effective, incredibly intelligent forward play and great link play. But overall, I guess, and it applies to the two games, it was just great to see England's sort of new plan, one that I think with quite a lot of us had talked about, especially around the Croatia semi-final at the World Cup, and that need then to have changed the system. And Gareth Southgate has shown that learning from mistakes and broadening his mind and changing styles is well within his sort of compass and among his strengths. And it was great that whole, you know, idea of whether, you know, was it just one blessed summer? Did we just get lucky? It doesn't have to be that way. You know, we're not world beaters. We've got a lot to improve, a lot to gain. But it's, you know, the conversation around England is different now than it has been for a lot of my professional career. You know, my kids talk about England because of what happened in the summer in a different way than they have talked about for a lot of their lives, and that is a good thing.
One issue, though, is that and it's increasingly an issue, I think, for a lot of some of the bigger national sides in Europe, is some of these England players who we admired, like Barkley and Winks, they just don't get a lot of minutes at club level. James, we know why this is the case, which is that, you know, frankly, even a team like Chelsea or Spurs would probably wipe the floor with most national teams, including England. What can be done? What should be done? Does it even really matter? I mean, is it really, as long as Winks trains all years and does well enough, Winks or Barkley does well enough when they get called upon, is it such a bad thing if they play fewer minutes and then play a lot with a national team?
There's a big difference, first of all. There's a big difference between not playing at all and playing a bit. And I think that's something that's really, you know, germane in the case of Barkley and Winks. You know, they've both gone through long periods where they really haven't played virtually at all, maybe in the kind of domestic cups, but they haven't really played much sort of frontline football. And in the past month, they both have, you know, whether they're first choice starters, you know, maybe not, but they've played enough to come back into Gareth Southgate's thinking. And I think what's kind of interesting is what you touched on, that, you know, England are in a pretty good place right now. You know, I think they're a pretty good team. They obviously are coming off a, you know, World Cup semi-final. The ceiling is high, but the entry point is pretty low. You know, you don't have to, you know, you really don't have to do a lot to come back into contention for the squad. You know, Ross Barkley and all Wings.
Unless you're Glenn Murray, who keeps getting overlooked.
Yeah, true. As we said, they've, you know, really not played very much at all for a long period, you know, probably about 12 months in both cases. And, you know, it's really only taken probably 3, 4, 5 good performances in both cases for them to come back into the squad. You don't have to be playing all the time, but I think you have to be playing a little bit. And I think any other players who are kind of watching what's happened with Ross Barkley and how quickly he has come back into being, you know, in contention for an England place will probably look at that and think, you know, I need to get minutes.
Are you as bullish as James is about Barkley and Winks?
I think they're going to get game time. I mean, it's
a club level.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I mean, Barkley. Sarri seems to have some trust in Barkley. Barkley's talked himself about that. He feels like he's. I mean, his problem has been absorbing, understanding positional play. You know, he's changed. He, I remember having long chats with David Moyes about it, about how, you know, when he was younger, he was very much the sort of Gerrard all-action player. He had obviously terrible injuries, came back a different player, a slightly different mindset. But the biggest issue they were trying to get through to him was about, yeah, off-ball work, about positioning, about discipline, tactical play. And, you know, there seems to be something good happening between those two that seems to be developing his game. It's sort of, it feels a bit belated, to be honest, but it seems to be happening. And he's obviously not going to be playing every game, but there seems to be a rotation of those midfield players that's going to give him enough game time that he will be in England squads. And I think the same will be true of Winks. He's going to play enough that Southgate will be able to pick him and not fret too much that he's rusty.
I agree with Matt. I think both those players have a shot at getting a reasonable amount of game time between now and the end of the season. I think in Barkley's case, he appears to be, you know, at least the fourth choice midfielder in Sarri's plans. And, you know, with a three-man midfield, Sarri's going to want to rotate. And I think clearly he is going to play some minutes, unless Mateo Kovacic starts playing absolutely out of this world. And just,
or Ruben Loftus-Cheek.
Well, I don't think that...
That's old.
Love Ruben. I don't think he doesn't appear to be in Sarri's plans at all. And I think we'll go on and talk about Tottenham, but I think with Winks, I think Moussa Dembele appears to be in quite drastic decline, and I think Winks has we'll come on to that.
Yeah. Some people are really bored or don't understand this Wembley story.
Okay.
So we should ask Dicko to explain it to us, because if you picked up the paper or if you went on the Times app after 5 o'clock yesterday, as I did, you saw this really impassioned piece by Henry Winter talking about, I think it started with describing sort of a tear slowly trickling down the
lovely
face of English football.
It made me emotional, yeah. I must say.
And then you wonder, what does this have to do with a stadium not being sold? Background, this guy named Shad Khan, the guy with the mustache who owns Fulham, made a bid, or it was £600 million plus various add-ons plus various guarantees to basically buy Wembley. This would have been a big cash infusion for the Football Association. And the thinking, people like Henry and what the people at the top of the FA, they made the point, well, we're going to take these monies and contribute it to the grassroots. The Football Foundation also coming out very strongly, saying we could have bought pitches and stuff like that. My personal take was always that without knowing the exact numbers, and I don't know, who knows how much Wembley Stadium really is worth, it's kind of hard to tell. Other people, like the FA Council, who it became pretty clear would have voted against it, and which is why Shahid Khan withdrew his offer, other people felt differently. The FA Council, again, for those who don't know, is sometimes dismissively described as the Blazer Brigade. It's 127 people, many of whom actually are grassroots football in this, or who, you know, run smaller clubs, amateur clubs, stuff like that. They were against it, as was Dicko Gary Neville, who I'm a big fan of. You're much closer to him, I think, than any of us. He said it was ridiculous. He said that there was other ways to raise this money. Who are you siding with, God or Mammon here, Henry or Gary? And you can't sit on the fence.
Well, I disagree with Henry on a few points. I mean, he's, you know, part of Henry's sort of, as you say, impassioned piece this morning is that he sort of hates Wembley full stop, which I don't get. I like the idea of a national stadium. This isn't a question of whether it should be in London or Manchester or Birmingham. I think it's at Wembley because historically there was a site there. That site has a heck of a lot of prestige. And I like the idea, full stop, of a national stadium. I liked, as a kid growing up, dreaming of, well, I dreamt of playing there, but dreamt even of just going to watch a game there. I've left occasions at Wembley, you know, old and new Wembley, feeling proud that this country, you know, has a place that a lot of the world aspires to visit as well. And, there's massive regeneration around the area. There's a university sort of on the doorstep, there's, you know, new buildings, new restaurants, and it is no longer a dump to visit. So, you know, I think Wembley's got a lot going for it. And, you know, the fact is that the FA sums were always that, you know, they took on a lot of debt, they would pay off that debt, and then it would make a small profit, which would then go into English football. And unless they're, you know, unless they've been lying, that path is still, you know, it's going to take until 2024, I understand, to pay off the debt. But when that is paid off, there will be more money, not a fortune, but more money going back into English football. So if that, you know, if that, unless they are, you know, hoodwinking us with that, then if that remains the case, then absolutely, I saw a case for examining selling it. I think it had to be taken seriously, this offer. I didn't think the money, much as it could be well used, was going to be transformative for every little kid in the country who dreams of playing football. I crave more 3G pitches like everyone else. But so if you're asking me to sort of come down on one side or the other, I want more money and I want the FA to use it sensibly. But, you know, if the sums are right that they can still make a profit from this, that it's good for English football, then the collapse of this shouldn't be a nightmare.
That was basically Gary Neville's argument as well, right?
Well, the thing is, there is mistrust about some of the sums, which is, you know, you can understand that mistrust for a number of reasons. And, you know, the FA sort of, obviously the hierarchy wanted to sell it. So then suddenly sort of briefings were coming out about, oh, well, we might have to spend a fortune to fix this or fix that. You know, and that's coming 6 months after we're told, no, we're on course to pay off the debt and to, you know, make a profit. So there's, you know, and I don't think the FA, you know, from all I've heard, that did themselves any favours by talking about, well, if they sold it, the money could be value matched by other organisations. You know, it was over. I think, you know, that's why a lot of the council kicked against it. It was sort of oversold the potential value of this deal. I think there was a degree of mistrust around the figures, which hasn't helped or didn't help the FA's case in trying to push the sale.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility, there's more to iPhone.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Let's move on to Tottenham then, who of course are playing their home games at the moment at Wembley, but they make the trip to the London Stadium on Saturday to face West Ham in the Premier League. It marks the start of a tough stretch of fixtures. West Ham away, PSV away and Manchester City at home, and then it doesn't get much better after that. PSV again, Palace away, Inter and a North London derby as well on December the 1st. Jan Vertonghen, Dele Alli could miss that entire spell. And James, can we come up with constructive suggestions for Pochettino?
Dele Alli is not the player that he was. He's evolved and he's no longer so much that sort of, you know, penalty box player, that sort of, you know, out-and-out second striker. He is more of a sort of creator. He's more sort of in a slightly deeper lying position. So it's really exacerbated by the fact that Moussa Dembele, all right, albeit he is not a direct creator or assist provider in the same way that Ali and Eriksen are, but he's been pretty reliable for Tottenham in previous seasons at moving the ball into the final third. He, for reasons that are not particularly clear, his performance has really nosedived, to be honest, if you look at the stats in terms of the pretty much everything. I mean, I wrote about it in the game two or three weeks ago, the sort of number of passes he's playing, you know, the number of passes he's playing into the final third. All his production has just really fallen away, and that is a huge problem for Tottenham because it just leaves them with a sort of massive kind of creativity hole in the centre of the pitch, and obviously one which, you know, Eric Dier, for all his strengths, is not really his game, and he's not really going to fill that.
Or Wanyama wouldn't fit.
Yeah, I do think Harry Winks does have a role to play. I think in many ways he's still, clearly because of the amount of senior football he's played, he's still quite unproven in some ways, but he does have the sort of passing game that might at least help to fill some of that. It is tricky. I think one thing that has really helped Tottenham and that will, you know, continue to help them if these injuries are serious is that Kieran Trippier has really developed over the last sort of few months and has really evolved into an extremely creative fullback. And so he's kind of taking up a little bit of that slack, which is helping. But yeah, it's a big problem for Pochettino.
Some have suggested that by the time Vertonghen returns in December, Spurs could be in the Europa League, having finished third in their Champions League group.
Can I say something? And this isn't directed. It's the absolute arrogance. Oh, they could be the Europa League and finish third. No, they could be last.
Well, they could
be home. They
yes.
could be done.
Okay.
Scoreboard, 0 points.
All right, Gab.
Seriously.
But let's just be slightly positive for Tottenham and Tottenham fans.
There's nothing to be positive about here. And you know what? Actually, you know, if you want to be positive, actually, for Spurs, it might even be better, if they are going to have all these injuries, it might even be better to be out with it already, since the squad isn't that big. Right.
Yeah, okay.
And then you can maybe focus on getting to the top four. But I love this little assumption. Ooh, like they could be third. You know? No, they could be last.
No,
they have zero
true.
Points right now.
Yes.
And I mean, look, you're right. These games are pretty huge. PSV should have beaten Inter Milan or should at least had a draw. Right. They are certainly better, I think, than their results show. This game is huge. Spurs don't win this game, it's over, I think. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe not mathematically, but realistically, it's over. And then maybe you can You can think about tanking the rest of your Champions League matches, see how that goes. But it's a really tough spot to be in. And you realize, I think, with Vertonghen out, you're stuck with Alderweireld, Davinson Sanchez. And if there's one thing we know is that Pochettino occasionally likes shifting them around, sometimes switching to a three, sometimes alternating the two. I don't think he's got the option. He's not going to have the option to do that right now. So it just adds further misery. I think this is the single biggest test of Pochettino's ability to come up with something, whether it's following the Gierbrandt suggestion tactically, put your faith in Winks or whatever. But I'll tell you what, if Pochettino gets through this, his credentials for being one of the best managers in the Premier League, I think, are just further burnished, because this situation really is not his fault.
But then does this all play into the narrative that Tottenham didn't strengthen in the summer, Matt?
There's obviously a danger. I mean, I know Matthew Syed wrote a piece sort of saying, well, this shows, you know, that it empowers players, it gives them responsibility. And obviously we just talked about Winks, and there's room for improvement from Tottenham without buying players. You can see that there's and Pochettino's, done a great job of sort of moving on, developing players. Football, you tend to a lot of the time get what you pay for, and Tottenham have been punching above their financial weight for 3, 4, 5 years. I mean, that's a fact. For them to come in the top four takes people to go above and beyond, and maybe there's a time when that's going to run out.
Hi there, and welcome to The Sweeper, the Times' fantasy football tip service. It's game week 9. I'm Charlie Scott, and I'm joined by Paddy Bombear.
Hello.
So, Paddy, what should we be worrying about this week?
Well, I am slightly worried about something that I saw a few days ago, which was Alexander Mitrovic dropping in price.
Really?
It seems that fantasy managers are abandoning him, which I'm very confused by, and would urge you not to follow suit. Fulham have got Huddersfield, Cardiff and Bournemouth, I think, in their next three. He's still the focal point striker of a good attacking team. And while you're at it, I'll suggest buying Andre Schürrle as well.
Yeah, nice. 5.9 million for Schürrle and owned by 4.8% of managers. So get a bit of a jump on your rivals and your mini leagues with that one.
Absolutely. And what about Liverpool? Injuries abound.
I mean, there's so many. They all went off on their international break, and the list is Salah, Mane, Keita, Van Dijk.
Yeah.
Milner's already injured.
Yeah. It always happens in international breaks, and it's why we always warn you, don't make any transfers too early in the double week off. I think the advice this week is wait until Jurgen Klopp has his say in his press conference. He may confirm who's out, who's in, who's not. He may not, of course, but if he does, then it's going to make your life a lot easier.
There's one man whose return is imminent.
Yes, Kevin De Bruyne?
Yes.
Yeah. I think he's obviously an important part to the City team. He loads of assists, about 20 a season for the past 2 years, and a few goals with it. He'll probably play this weekend, but he may start from the bench, so I would say give it a week. Then they've got Spurs away. Maybe give it 2 weeks before you sign him, but he's definitely one to get on your radar. More important, I think, is to try and get Benjamin Mendy back in your team.
Yeah.
If you're one of the many who sold him, he's fit again and probably going to start scoring points like he did at the start of the season.
Captain picks, who are you thinking this weekend?
Oh, I'd love to captain Salah if he's fit, away to Huddersfield. And if Klopp gives me the green light, I think I will. But otherwise, it's got to be Aguero, doesn't it?
Aguero against Burnley, yeah, you'd think so. Although Man United, just their defence is all over the shop. I quite like Hazard.
He is in form.
Against Mourinho. I like that.
Plenty of tips to come this week in our email. Just sign up at thetimes.co.uk/fantasyfootball, or just follow the link in the podcast description. And we've got a Facebook group as well.
We do. Just search for The Sweeper on Facebook and join the fam.
Time now for our weekly predictions game, where after weeks and weeks of going head to head, it is now Marcotti 4, Sawyer 4.
Yes, you're the comeback kid. You're basically Jose Mourinho.
Oh.
I mean in a good way.
Okay.
Coming back from,
well, I don't know,
deficit.
Long term, if that's good.
Speaking of, let's get started at his old home, Chelsea against Manchester United. What do you got?
Well, I just don't think it's going to get any easier for them. So I'm going for a 2-1 Chelsea win.
Yeah, I'm on board with that. I'm just going to say 2-0.
South Coast Derby to look forward to. Bournemouth against Southampton.
Bournemouth are doing well. The question you always wonder, can it last? I think this break takes some momentum away from them. I'm going to go for a 1-1 draw.
Oh, okay. Well, I, on the other hand, think that Bournemouth are doing really well. They're unbeaten at home this season, taking on a side who are on a bit of a losing streak as well. So I'm only seeing an Eddie Howe side victory for this one, a 2-0 win for Bournemouth.
You like Eddie more than Sparky, don't you? You do, don't you?
Yeah, I think I do, but I don't know why. I just think I do. Yeah,
that's fine.
What about the game at Goodison Park? Everton against Crystal Palace.
I still find it hard to judge Everton. I've bigged up Marco Silva for so long. They bring in all these players. They're coming along little by little. As you know, I was a big Bernard guy. He's shown glimpses, but I think the issue with Palace right now is I think they've got some serious injuries up front. So I have Everton here, 1-0.
Oh, snap. That's the same for me. 1-0 win.
Ooh, moving down into the lower stretches of the football food chain. Aston Villa and the Swans.
Yes.
Now, this is nice because it's Dean Smith and Richard O'Kelly. O'Kelly, sorry.
Boyle, is that what a classic Irish name?
It's weird because I've obviously been familiar with many people's last name is Kelly, but he's the only O'Kelly. Is that common? The O, O and then Kelly?
I don't know now you've said
that. I'm assuming you know more Irish people than I do, right?
Yeah, but I don't know any O'Kellys other than Richard O'Kelly.
Is your boyfriend Irish?
He is, but he's not an O'Kelly.
Ask him if he knows any O'Kellys except for this one.
I will do.
All right, and we can report back on Monday.
Who will?
And the Swans have had a slightly difficult time, yes. If I'm not mistaken.
Well, yes, but not as bad as Aston Villa, who only won one of their last 10. But I actually just think the new manager effect, and obviously maybe I still have a soft spot for Dean Smith, I think he's going to inspire a 2-1 win.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to go in the opposite direction. Ooh. And pick Swansea to win 1-0.
Okay. We're going to hop over to Germany for our final game. Wolfsburg against Bayern Munich.
Wolfsburg, which of course isn't really a football club, it's a football works team, because if you've ever been to Wolfsburg, it really is. It's a train station with the VW plant attached to it. You can actually see it from the train, taking on a struggling Bayern Munich
really
team.
Struggling.
It'll be interesting to see, too, like the Bayern players coming back from the Germany experience, where they played much, much better against France. Dare I say they were unlucky to lose, I thought. But by the same token, you know, you've got some guys who've been dropped, like Jerome Boateng. You've got, and Thomas Muller, of course. It's a tough time for them. I'm going to go for the draw here. 2-2.
Oh, well, I've gone for the draw as well, but I've gone for a 1-1 draw. Just time to give you the answer to Bill Edgar's teaser. We asked you, as of the start of the Premier League era in 1992, Liverpool had won the most major trophies among English clubs, 33. But who was second on that list? Gab, you went for Arsenal, possibly, or Everton.
That's right. It's Dean Smith's new stomping ground. It's Aston Villa.
There you go.
Yeah, you sort of forgot it. Because I was so focused on Premier League clubs, but... No, obviously.
Because there was no football before the Premier League.
Exactly.
It's confusing. I understand.
No, it does make sense that it was Villa and that it couldn't be United because that would have been too obvious. United were close, actually. Villa had won 18 major trophies. United had 17 and were third in that. So Alex Ferguson on his own won more trophies in 21 years than United have won in their entire history before or after.
Wow.
Pretty remarkable. And that's Manchester United we're talking, not some boxy team.
Yeah.
Anyway, many thanks to our guests today, James Gearbrandt and, of course, Matt Dickinson.
Remember, you can subscribe to The Times and The Sunday Times to enjoy award-winning journalism online and on your smartphone or tablet. It's just £1 a week for an 8-week trial. Search The Times subscription for more information.
We're going to be back on Monday with the return of the Champions League.
I'm not here.
No.
I'm actually going to Ireland, so I'll try and find an O'Kelly.
So, yeah, so it'll be just me on Monday. Well, not just me. I'll presumably have other guests in the studio with me. But sadly, no Natalie. And we'll be looking ahead to Manchester United against Juventus in the Champions League and looking back on the weekend's Premier League action.
The Game is brought to you by The Times. For more information and more podcasts from The Times, head to thetimes.co.uk.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on. Settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books. Contacts. Calendar. Double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.